Hi, and welcome to the Chris Business Hour. From the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater, and today, as always, we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with this week's Hartford Business Journal, we have an article written by Skylar Fraser. It's titled, Mott Corporation and Partners Receive a $10 Million Federal Grant for New Clean Hydrogen Technology. Farmington-based manufacturer Mott Corporation is getting $10 million in federal funding to design and produce clean energy technology, the company and the state's two U.S. senators announced. Democratic U.S. Senators Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal visited Mott Corp Wednesday to announce the grant award from the U.S. Department of Energy, or DOE. The funding was included in Congress's 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law to help accelerate the design and production of clean energy technology. Mott Corporation is a manufacturer that produces filtration systems used in the aerospace, clean energy, and electric vehicles industry. Per the grant, Mott will partner with Wallingford-based Nel Hydrogen, Forge Nano, and the University of Connecticut to produce the next generation of metal porous transport layers, which are important components for hydrogen production, the companies said. These parts will help reduce the cost of clean hydrogen, according to information from the company, and aid the federal government's goal to reduce costs to $1 per kilogram by 2030. The $10 million federal grant will be matched with $2.5 million in private sector support from Mott Corporation and other partners, the company said. Founded in 1959, Mott Corp has been steadily growing in Connecticut in recent years through expansions and acquisitions. Last year, the company said it would be opening up a new 65,000-square-foot facility near its Farmington headquarters that will double production capacity for its custom-designed engineering business. A few weeks later, the company said it had acquired a Michigan-based engineering company that specializes in advanced water filtration systems. Next, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson is titled, Doro Restaurant Group Plans Aggressive Expansion in Three Towns. And I will say, my wife and I love Doro. Doro Restaurant Group is planning an aggressive expansion in Greater Hartford, opening new restaurants in Wethersfield, Glastonbury, and Newington, along with a centralized bakery and a commercial kitchen for its catering business. Doro Restaurant Group, led by business partners Dorjan Puka and Scott Miller, owns and operates seven restaurants, including Zohara Mediterranean Kitchen, Avert Brassiere, and Treva Restaurant and Bar, all in the West Hartford Center, along with ABC Artisanal Burger Company in Manchester. They opened their first restaurant, Treva, 14 years ago. Since then, Doro has grown to 400 employees. The new projects are expected to add about 200 more people, Miller said. Miller declined to say how much money the company is investing in its expansion, but said the investment is self-funded. The fastest-growing piece of the business is Doro Marketplace, a European-style bakery and cafe, which currently has three locations in Wethersfield, Windsor Locks, and West Hartford. We currently run three Doro Marketplaces, but the infrastructure will be in place to open up nine more, said Miller, chief operating officer of the restaurant group, in an interview with the Hartford Business Journal. The Doro Marketplace in Wethersfield is at 1301 Silas Dean Highway, the former Chips family restaurant. Half a mile up the road, the company is embarking on a new project. Doro recently received zoning approval to convert the vacant Pasta Vita, and BevMax package store in a commercial complex at 1142 Silas Dean Highway into a 2,450-square-foot restaurant, a 2,500-square-foot commercial bakery, and 5,400-square-foot commercial kitchen. The restaurant will feature authentic Mexican food, and Daro has already selected the chef. The current chef at Evert, Ryan Van Grau, worked for years at top restaurants in Tulum, Mexico, and will move from the French restaurant Evert to the new one when it opens this fall, Miller said. His heart and soul is with Mexican cuisine, Miller said. He has a really established palate in regards to their cuisine. With restaurants in the Mediterranean, French, and Italian genres already open, Daro's expansion will add a new style of ethnic cuisine. Myself and my partner, Dorjan, are chefs by trade, Miller said, adding, we've always thought about where we're going to go next with our culinary concepts and our restaurant concepts, and we've just been enamored with Mexican food. Miller said the restaurant will offer an elevated Mexican dining experience using high-quality ingredients, some of which will be imported from Mexico, at about the same price point as any other Mexican restaurant. He believes it will fill a need in the area. The flavors and authenticity of some of these dishes have been around for a long time, but we're going to be making them approachable to Harford County, Miller said. The key word is approachable. It's knowing your market, and I think we understand the dining culture of Harford County, Miller added. The commercial bakery will serve as a centralized baking facility for the restaurant groups, pastry chefs, and bread makers. Most of the pastry chefs and bread makers are currently based in West Hartford in a space Miller said they've outgrown. The commercial bakery will be designed to support as many as 12 Daro Marketplace cafes. We think Wethersfield is a very good location for us to grow because of its proximity to both I-84 and I-91, and it's a central market of Hartford, Miller said. The commercial kitchen will house Daro Catering and Events, another rapidly growing part of the business, which has its own dedicated staff. The new facility will put the bread and pastry making chefs along with the catering staff under one roof. Daro is also expanding in Glastonbury, where it has secured a site for a new Zohara restaurant and Daro Marketplace. They will share a building at 2343 and 2345 Main Street in a commercial space previously occupied by a cycling store. Both restaurants should open in the first quarter of 2025, Miller said. Also, Daro is converting a former Bertucci's at 2929 Berlin Turnpike in Newington into an Italian restaurant. He said construction should begin soon, and the restaurant is expected to open in the late fall. Next, an article written by Michael Puffer. Is titled PC Hardwood Floors to Open Hartford Location After a $2.75 million Brainerd Road Property Purchase. A Hartford property that formerly housed Connecticut Lighting Center's headquarters will eventually host a PC Hardwood Floors store following a $2.75 million sale in late March. D&C Family LLC, a company tied to Connecticut Lighting Centers, sold the 18,920-square-foot retail building on 1 acre located at 160 Brainerd Road to Capital Enterprise of Orange County Incorporated of New York. The buyer's principal, Solomon Weiss, heads up PC Hardwood Floors. Goleman & York Property Advisors LLC listed the property and brokered the deal. Rob Montesi, Senior Vice President of Transactional Services for Goleman & York, said the property went on the market for lease after Connecticut Lighting consolidated elements of the growing company in three nearby locations into a single large property on Murphy Road. Various would-be tenants considered the property over roughly 18 months. PC Hardwood Floors considered a lease but ultimately preferred to purchase the site, which was an option Gorman & York had previously broached with Connecticut Lighting ownership Montesi Sad. Montesi said PC Hardwood Floors will renovate the property at 160 Brainerd Road for use as a new retail and wholesale location. Attempts to reach a PC Hardwood Floors representative were not immediately successful Wednesday morning. The company currently operates three locations in New York, three in New Jersey, and two in Connecticut in Danbury and Waterbury. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Michael Puffer. It's titled, Newington Warehouse Sells for $1.35 million to a Massachusetts Heavy Equipment Dealer. A limited liability company linked to Massachusetts-based heavy equipment dealer C.N. Wood recently paid $1.35 million for a 17,520-square-foot Newington warehouse that formerly served as a dealer location for heavy equipment manufacturer Komatsu. C.N. Wood Realty Newington LLC bought the 1972 vintage warehouse on 4.5 acres at 283 Payne Road from Chicago-based Komatsu America Corporation in a sale recorded by the town on January 25th. In May of 2022, C.N. Wood announced it had purchased assets of Komatsu dealer locations in Newington, as well as in Pine Bush, New York, and Holmes, New York. The deal will make C.N. Wood a regional powerhouse with customer-focused ideals stretching from upstate New York and throughout New England, reads a portion of the 2022 post on C.N. Wood's website. The deal provided distribution rights for Komatsu products and services throughout Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and into New York along the Hudson Valley to Poughkeepsie, according to the Post. Next, an article written by Skylar Fraser titled Finance Committee Approves a Bill to Limit Credit Card Interchange Fees. A proposal that would change how fees for electronic sales are calculated received support from Connecticut restaurant owners, but pushback from credit union and payment industry groups as it heads to the State House of Representatives for more discussion. House Bill 5489, which was introduced by the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee, would prohibit payment card networks from including sales and use taxes in interchange fees charged to retailers and other companies that accept credit cards. The bill would essentially require credit card companies to either exclude taxes from their interchange fee calculations or reimburse businesses for the same amount if they are not excluded during fee payments. The Connecticut Restaurant Association said that including taxes when calculating interchange fees unnecessarily inflates the cost to small businesses. The association said restaurants in the state are being charged 2% to 4% in interchange fees while credit card use continues to increase. The vast majority of Connecticut restaurants are small businesses, many of them family-run, and under current law, they are being unfairly penalized with interchange fees on every single electronic transaction at their business, says Scott Dulch, president and CEO of the Connecticut Restaurant Association. It's a growing cost that is becoming increasingly burdensome as more and more consumers shift to cashless payments. That's why we are here today asking Connecticut legislators for a simple fix. Stop banks and card networks from essentially marking up their interchange fees on the backs of Connecticut small businesses. Both the Credit Union League of Connecticut and the Electronic Transactions Association spoke out against the bill, arguing the proposal would force merchants to fully overhaul their payment systems. They also said that interchange fees are important because they help pay for investment in secure payments technology. Unwise governmental intervention with a complicated payment ecosystem, such as a prohibition on collecting interchange on the sales tax portion of electronic payment transactions, threatens innovation and system security that is funded in part through the collection of interchange, said Brian Yates, Senior Director of State Government Affairs at the Electronic Transactions Association. He added, the unworkable nature of the proposal is emphasized by the fact that over 60 similar state legislative proposals to prohibit interchange on the sales tax portion of electronic transactions have been considered between 2006 and 2023, and none have ever passed their respective state legislature. So what's next? The Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee this week approved the bill in a 35-16 vote, with some Democrats and Republicans voting in favor and some against. It's now up to the State House of Representatives to take up the bill for further discussion and a possible vote. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with more after this break.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Ackerman, a Chris Radio volunteer, with an invitation to join your friends at the Cheshire Lions Club's 66th Annual Dinner Dance for the Blind, to be held Monday, May 6th, 6 to 9:30 p.m. at the AquaTurf Club in Plantsville. This annual party is dedicated to those who have lost their sight and to all Lions who serve by helping in the fight against blindness. The cost is $40 per person, but there is no charge for visually impaired guests and their drivers when sponsored by the Cheshire Lions Club or one of the other area Lions clubs or businesses. For more information about the dance or to register your attendance, please call Lion Bill Manthe at 203-723-4821. That's Bill Manthe at 203-723-4821, or by email at CheshireCTLionsClub@gmail.com. CheshireCTLionsClub@gmail.com. RSVPs need to be in by Monday, April 22nd, so call or email today.
Jumping back into this week's Hartford Business Journal, we have an article written by Skylar Fraser. It's titled, Labor Committee Sends Dozens of Bills to the House and the Senate. These proposals would impact businesses. The General Assembly's Labor and Public Employees Committee recently approved several dozen bills, including numerous measures that would significantly impact Connecticut businesses. The bills were sent to the full House and Senate for further consideration. Lawmakers have until May 8th, the end of this year's legislative session, to act on the proposals. Several of the bills faced opposition from the business community, including one that would phase out the state's tipped minimum wage and another that would expand Connecticut's paid sick and family medical leave program. Many of the bills were approved along party line votes, with 8 Democrats in favor and 4 Republicans in opposition. The Democratic co-chairs of the committee are Senator Julie Kushner of Danbury and Representative Manny Sanchez of New Britain. The ranking member Republicans on the committee are Senator Rob Sampson of Wolcott and Representative Steve Weir from Hebron. Bills voted out of the Labor Committee along party line votes included 1. Paid sick days expansion. Senate Bills 7 and 12 and House Bill 5005 all expand the state's paid sick days law. They require all employers to provide employees with paid sick days regardless of company size. Under current statutes, only employers with more than 50 employees are required to provide paid sick days. The bills would also expand the permitted purposes for which an employee may use a paid sick day, such as counseling for a physical or psychological injury or disability. They also expand the definition of who qualifies as a family member when a worker wants to use a paid sick day to include an individual's parents and domestic partners. Next bill voted out of the Labor Committee, striking workers' benefits. House Bill 5164 allows striking employees to access unemployment benefits after 2 consecutive weeks on the picket lines. It's similar to a Democratic proposal that passed in the state Senate last year but did not get through the House. According to the Office of Fiscal Analysis, a nonpartisan fiscal research office for the legislature, the bill results in a one-time cost of $396,000 to the state's general fund. If striking workers become eligible for unemployment benefits, it would also result in a cost to Connecticut's unemployment trust fund, which is funded by employers. The next bill on tipped wages. Senate Bill 221 phases out the lower minimum wage for hourly employees who earn tips, which would force many restaurants to increase wages. Connecticut's hourly minimum wages for waitstaff and bartenders are $6.38 and $8.23, respectively. The state's regular minimum wage is $15.69 per hour. Waitstaff and bartenders are still required to earn at least $15.69, but tips count toward that total. If tips don't get workers to the $15.69 threshold, employers are required by law to make up the difference. Next bill, non-compete agreements, House Bill 5269. Bans new non-compete agreements for employees who are paid below 3 times the minimum wage and independent contractors who are paid below 5 times the minimum wage. It also bans non-compete agreements when a worker leaves for good cause and does not allow such agreements to last longer than 1 year. Next bill, prescription drug benefits. House Bill 5386 requires employers or insurers acting on behalf of employees to provide notice of a proposed discontinuance or reduction of coverage of an employee's prescription medication and get approval from an administrative law judge before it takes effect. Unpaid subcontractor wages. Senate Bill 409 makes a contractor liable for unpaid wages owed to an employee of a subcontractor who performs work on any portion of a construction contract. Warehouse quotas. Senate Bill 412 creates protections for warehouse workers against unreasonable quotas imposed by employers. For example, it would restrict the use of quotas based solely on ranking the performance of one employee in relation to the performance of other employees. It also requires employers to provide a written description to new hires of each quota the employee is or will be subject to, and any potential adverse employment action that may result from failing to meet each quota. Next, work schedule changes. Senate Bill 413 requires retail, food services, hospitality, and long-term health care providers with 500 or more employees to provide workers 14 days advance notice of their work schedules with limited ability to make schedule changes. It also requires employers to pay workers extra if they don't provide enough advance of a schedule change. And 2 bills that passed out of the Labor Committee with bipartisan support included wage and hour inspectors. House Bill 5384 increases the number of wage and hour inspectors at the Labor Department in order to monitor the increasing number of wage theft complaints in the state, and paid time off. House Bill 5468 did not have full consensus, State Senator Sampson voted against it, while his three Republican peers voted in favor of it, but would require employers to provide 12 months' notice prior to making changes to their paid time off policy. Next, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini. It's titled, Bimbo Bakeries Closing Three Connecticut Outlet Sites. Bimbo Bakeries USA, and I'll admit I never heard of it, will close three Connecticut outlet locations in Orange, Cromwell, and Naugatuck, company officials said. Bimbo Bakeries USA is an affiliate of Grupo Bimbo, a baking company with operations in 34 countries. The company makes products for Entenmann's, Fryhoffer's, Sara Lee, and Thomas's Breads. The company said, after careful analysis and consideration, we made the difficult decision to permanently close 28 of our outlet stores throughout the East region. They said company processes have shifted and products will be redistributed to other locations which were not disclosed. According to the company website, Bimbo has more than 20,000 associates who work in bakeries, sales centers, offices, and on sales routes. The company did not say how many jobs the closures would affect, but added it is taking steps to help ease them through this transition. The company said it will donate any extra products to local food bank partners. Next up, an article written by David Krzyzewski. It's titled, National Company Opens Its First New England Autism Therapy Clinic in Shelton. Helping Hands Family, which provides therapy for children with autism, has opened a clinic in Shelton, its first in New England. The organization has 25 clinics in four other states, including 18 in Pennsylvania, three each in New Jersey and Maryland, and one in New York. Helping Hands Family provides applied behavior analysis, or ABA, therapy, the only treatment endorsed by both the American Psychological Association and the Surgeon General for individuals on the autism spectrum. Decades of research have shown ABA to be effective in improving core challenges associated with autism, including social interaction, communication, learning, and behavior, the organization said. The new Shelton Clinic, located at 1 Greenwich Place, serves clients in both Shelton and Trumbull. Nikki Marchetti, Senior Relationship Liaison for Helping Hands Family, said it is possible her organization could open additional clinics in Connecticut. While our focus for the immediate future is on reaching full capacity at our Shelton location, providing ABA therapy to children, we are open to the prospect of further expansion within Connecticut, as we know our services would be of great value to families throughout the state, she said. The Shelton Clinic has 23 employees, but is looking to expand its staff, she said. To further expand our capacity and impact on the community, we are looking to add an additional 30 registered behavior technicians and 5 board-certified behavior analysts, Marchetti said. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., Saturdays from 8 to 2, and Sunday by appointment. The clinic accepts most insurance plans and will assist in applying for coverage. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson titled, Connecticut Receives Federal Grant to Open New Women's Business Center in Hartford. State officials announced on Tuesday that the United States Small Business Administration, or SBA, is providing a grant to establish a new Women's Business Center in Hartford. It will be one of 5 women's business centers under the umbrella of the Women's Business Development Council, or WBDC. The others are in Stamford, New Haven, New London, and Waterbury, which recently opened. Women's Business Centers offers one-on-one counseling, training, networking, workshops, technical assistance, and mentoring to women entrepreneurs. Women entrepreneurs and small business owners in the Greater Hartford region deserve excellence, and that is what they will receive from WBDC's programs and services. Our new host of SBA's Women's Business Center in Hartford, said Catherine Marks, SBA's district director. The multi-level support vis-a-vis the City of Hartford, State of Connecticut, and SBA confirms our collective commitment to ensure women have the tools to grow and succeed, she added. Although women are still underrepresented in the workforce, progress is being made. SBA said its loans to women-owned businesses are up 70% and that women are starting businesses across industries at higher rates than their male counterparts. More than $5 billion has been loaned to women-owned businesses in fiscal year 2023, a 61% increase according to the SBA. The Women's Business Development Council is headquartered in Stamford. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with the second half of this week's show after this break.
Hi, I'm Mario Cajar, a Chris Radio volunteer, inviting you to join the Connecticut Lions for their 17th annual Visually Impaired Persons Fishing Tournament. The junior division for children 3 to 18 years old will be held Sunday, April 28th at Sage Park Pond in Berlin. Registration and breakfast begins at 8:30 a.m., fishing at 9, followed by lunch and an awards presentation. Breakfast, lunch, and all fishing equipment will be provided at no charge by the Berlin Lions. Applications are due by April 6th, so don't delay. Get your application in today for this fun day with friends and fishing. The Senior Division Tournament will be held Monday, May 20th. And again this year, you'll be heading out to sea from Niantic aboard the Blackhawk Sport Fishing Charter, going for fluke, porgy, or whatever else is biting. Registration deadline for the Senior Division is April the 27th.
For more information and applications, call Laurie Satkowski at 860-250-4663. That's 860-250-4663. Or email Laurie at Satkowski@sbcglobal.net.
We'll now jump into the Thursday, April 4th, New York Times, starting off with their business news roundup, the DealBook newsletter. First article in the newsletter, the takeaways from Disney's board fight with Nelson Peltz. It's over. Disney fended off the activist investor Nelson Peltz for the second time in 2 years as its shareholders rejected his effort to win 2 seats on its board. The House of Mouse claimed a substantial margin of victory after a bitterly fought contest with Peltz and his major backer, the former Marvel chair Ike Perlmutter. Based on preliminary results from Wednesday's annual investor meeting, Disney's board candidates won the backing of 75% of individual shareholders, an outsized investor base. But like any good Disney tale, the board fight provided a series of lessons for the future, for companies and activists alike. A robust defense matters. Executives led by the Disney CEO, Bob Iger, mapped out a series of bold initiatives last autumn, in part to blunt Peltz's calls for change, according to the Wall Street Journal. That included cost-cutting efforts, an investment in the video game giant Epic Games, and a shakeup in the struggling movie division. It helps that Disney's stock has risen 20% in the past year, diminishing Peltz's argument that the company needed help. His biggest wins have come at companies like Procter & Gamble, where share prices languished. That almost certainly mattered a great deal to big investors like BlackRock and Vanguard, which sided with Disney. New proxy voting rules changed the fight's dynamics. For years, companies' shareholders were asked to choose between 2 slates of board candidates proposed either by the companies or by activist investors. But a new SEC rule allows shareholders to more easily vote for a mix of nominees from both sides. Parties involved in this battle told DealBook that because each side was fighting against specific individuals instead of against an entire slate, attacks became more personal. That said, there is no love lost between Perlmutter and Iger. The new system also enabled another activist investor in Disney stock, Blackwell's Capital, to campaign against Peltz, dividing the opposition. CEO succession planning matters. One of Peltz's biggest criticisms of Iger was his years-long failure to properly identify and prepare his replacement, as the aborted tenure of Bob Chapek showed. That issue was cited by the proxy advisory firm Institutional Shareholder Services, which recommended voting in Peltz. And State Street, one of Disney's three biggest shareholders, voted against re-electing Mark Parker, who leads the company's succession planning committee. Analysts and industry watchers expect Disney to redouble efforts to address succession ahead of 2026, when Iger's current, and by his account final, contract expires. Internal Disney candidates like the TV chief Dana Walden, the theme parks leader Josh DeMauro, and the ESPN head Jimmy Pitaro have been taking on more prominent assignments in recent months. For short what's happening business stories, first up, Janet Yellen defends protecting U.S. industries against China. The Treasury Secretary suggested overnight that the Biden administration would defend emerging sectors like clean energy against Chinese overcapacity, a topic she's expected to address with her counterparts in Beijing. That follows President Biden's addressing unfair trade practices with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping earlier this week. Next, Paramount rebuffs a $26 billion overture from Apollo. The approach this past weekend for the entire media company, representing an expansion of Apollo's $11 billion bid for just Paramount's movie studio, was ignored, the Times reports. Paramount executives were focused on advancing negotiations with another bid by Skydance and preferred the bird in hand. Next, Google reportedly weighs charging for AI-powered search features. The tech giant is considering making available only to subscribers of its premium services the advanced capabilities that draw upon its Gemini artificial intelligence model, according to the Financial Times. It would be the first time Google is charged for anything related to its core search business. And the last What's Happening short business article, Apple is said to explore home robots as its next big product. The iPhone maker is investigating the potential of personal robots and a robotic-driven display as future moneymakers, though the work is early and may not become full-fledged products, Bloomberg reports. Apple is casting about for hit products after abandoning its electric vehicle project and waiting possibly years for its Vision Pro to become mainstream. Next article in a business roundup, a cheat sheet for tomorrow's jobs report. Investors on Thursday still largely believe that the Fed will begin cutting interest rates in June. It's a bet that officials of the central bank themselves won't make. Jay Powell, the Fed chair, reiterated on Wednesday that it is waiting for more evidence that inflation is slowing before it begins lowering borrowing costs. Two major reports are arriving in the coming days, starting with tomorrow's non-farm payrolls report. Here's what to watch. Economists expect employers to have added at least 200,000 jobs last month, according to a Bloomberg survey. That would be a considerable drop-off from the 275,000 jobs created in February, but would still indicate a robust labor market. Our economy has been short labor and probably still is, Powell said on Wednesday. His contention was underscored by data from the payroll processor ADP that showed a surge in hiring, especially in the construction, leisure, and hospitality sectors. Following the ADP report, economists at Goldman Sachs raised their forecast for tomorrow's non-farm payroll numbers to 240,000 from 215,000. Next, look at immigration. While it's a hot-button political issue, it's also a focus of economists. Foreign-born workers have become a surprising part of the job growth story and may explain why the unemployment rate has gone up despite solid hiring figures. Robust immigration has also been a big factor in America's economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. Wage growth will be of particular interest. There are signs that workers' pay gains have begun to ease during the past year as inflation slowed. Wall Street is on alert for any signs that wages are ticking up, which could force the Fed to recalibrate its rate cut timeline. Here's a worst-case scenario for investors, according to economists at Bank of America. Job growth of 250,000 or more, stronger than expected wage growth, and a fall in the unemployment rate would likely further price out the chance of a June cut, they wrote in a research note this week. Next article from the roundup, shorting Trump has been a bad bet. Donald Trump's social media company has lost more than 30% in the past week in highly volatile trading. Despite that swoon, investors shorting the Trump Media and Technology Group are losing big. The souring trade, big difference there, is complicated by the fact that major asset managers have largely stayed away from the stock, leaving shorts to scrimp for a relatively small pool of shares to acquire and pay dearly for them. Trump Media is one of the most shorted stocks in the country and one of the costliest, according to S3 Partners, a financial data company. Last month, traders racked up $126 million in losses betting against Trump Media, the company said. Short sellers essentially borrow shares of a target company and sell them, hoping to buy them back at a lower price that locks in a profit. There is some rationale for investors to short the stock. Trump Media reported this week that it had lost $58 million last year on sales of about $4 million and that an independent auditor had expressed substantial doubt about its financial viability before it began trading last week. Many of the shorts are betting on a surge in Trump Media warrants, which would give holders the right to new company stock at a fixed price. The gamble? Regulators would have to give the company the green light to issue the new shares. Investors appear undeterred by such uncertainty. There are still so many people looking to short the name, Ihor Dusinowski, managing director of S3 Partners, told The Times. Elsewhere in Trump Media news, two brothers accused of masterminding a $23 million insider trading scheme involving the company in its pre-IPO days pleaded guilty to the charges on Wednesday. They each face prison sentences of up to 20 years. Next article, the open and closed case for AI. Of all the debates in artificial intelligence circles, one of the biggest comes down to access. Should companies make their tech available for anyone to view, change, and use, an approach known as open source? The White House, as part of its efforts to create new rules to govern AI, is wading into the debate. On Wednesday, it published more than 300 comments it has collected on the risks of open sourcing AI. The feedback boils down to two major categories. One, open source AI is fairer and safer. Meta, one of the biggest proponents of the approach, wrote that it leads to better, safer products, faster innovation, and a larger market. The startup incubator Y Combinator said such models may have a heightened potential for misuse, but they also allow for democratic contribution and oversight. And Andreessen Horowitz, the Silicon Valley venture capital firm that has invested in scores of AI startups, argued against any policies that would inhibit the development of open AI models. Its rationale, that open source software has become a foundation of the internet. And it's better to be cautious. Some of the biggest names in commercial AI, who stand to gain from keeping their tech proprietary, say that having tighter control of advanced systems protects against what OpenAI called the operations of a number of nation-state cyber threat actors. Google wrote that open and closed source sit on a spectrum and that it's better to talk about different degrees of access to different components of a given system. Next up from the New York Times, an article written by Melissa Eady titled "Inflation Cools in Eurozone Nearing Central Bank's Target." The annual inflation rate across most economies in Europe eased for the third month in a row, nearing the target set by the European Central Bank. Consumer prices in the 20 countries that use the euro rose 2.4% in the year through March, down from 2.6% the month before, the European Union reported on Wednesday. The rate was slightly lower than economists expected and brought overall inflation closer to the 2% target set by the ECB, which will hold its next meeting to set interest rates on April 11th. The central bank also keeps a close eye on core inflation, which strips out volatile food and energy prices. That dipped to 2.9% in the year through March in the eurozone, ticking below the 3% mark for the first time since Russia's full-scale war against Ukraine broke out in February 2022, driving up energy prices. Germany, the eurozone's largest economy, saw consumer prices rise at an annual rate of 2.3% in March, its slowest inflation since June of 2021. The latest numbers will support the notion that the ECB could soon begin to cut interest rates, which the bank held steady last month at 4%. But analysts believe the central bank will wait for more evidence that the cooling trend is holding. While core inflation eased, the stubbornness of services inflation and the desire for the ECB for more wage data makes an April rate cut unlikely, Rural Fennessy, an economist at Oxford Economics, wrote in a note. Inflation in the United States has cooled but faced a bumpy path, reinforcing the Federal Reserve's decision to proceed cautiously on potential interest rate cuts. The Bank of England has also held rates at relatively high levels amid signs that inflation in Britain is moderating. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Jenna Smilak and Santal Narkar. It's titled, "Fed Chair Awaits More Inflation Cooling as Path Proves Bumpy." Jerome Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, reiterated on Wednesday that the central bank can take its time before cutting interest rates as inflation fades and economic growth holds up. The central bank chief also used a speech at Stanford to emphasize the Fed's independence from politics, a relevant message at a time when election season threatens to pull Fed policy into an uncomfortable limelight. This year is a big one for the Fed. After long months of rapid inflation, price increases are finally coming down. That means the central bankers may soon be able to lower interest rates from their highest levels in two decades. The Fed raised rates to 5.3% from March 2022 to mid-2023 to cool the economy and bring inflation to heel. Figuring out when and how much to cut interest rates is tricky, though. Inflation has decelerated more slowly in recent months, and the Fed does not want to cut rates too early and fail to fully wrestle price increases under control. Investors had initially expected the Fed to lower rates early this year, but now see the first move coming in June or July as officials wait for more evidence that inflation has truly moderated. On inflation, it's too soon to say whether the recent readings represent more than just a bump, Mr. Powell said, adding, "We do not expect that it will be appropriate to lower our policy rate until we have greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably down toward 2%. Given the strength of the economy and progress on inflation so far, we have time to let the incoming data guide our decisions on policy," he added. He called reducing inflation a sometimes bumpy path. Fed officials face pressure from all sides as they contemplate their next move. While officials want to make sure that they have fully snuffed out inflation, many economists also warn that keeping rates too high for too long could weigh on the economy more than is necessary and cause job losses. There is no risk-free path, Mr. Powell acknowledged on Wednesday. Inflation cooled swiftly in 23, both as global supply chains healed, allowing goods prices to fall, and as prices for a number of services like rent stopped climbing so steeply. Services prices tie back in part to wage increases, which have moderated as more workers have joined the labor pool, partly thanks to strong immigration. There may be more supply-side gains to be had, Mr. Powell said, noting that the Fed's policies might also be weighing on demand for big purchases like cars and on the labor market. As the Fed waits to see what happens, taking time to start with rate cuts means that the Fed's first rate cut, and any subsequent ones, could come just as campaigning is heating up ahead of the presidential election in November. Former President Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, has already criticized the Fed for being political and said Mr. Powell was going to do something to probably help the Democrats. Mr. Trump elevated Mr. Powell to the role of Fed chair, though he has since been reappointed to the role by President Biden. The Fed is independent of the White House, and its officials often stress that they set policy with an eye on the economy and not politics. Mr. Powell did so on Wednesday, explaining that the Fed is insulated from partisan wrangling and is determined to ignore such pressures. "We're just calling balls and strikes on the economy as we see them," Mr. Powell said. He later added that when the Fed contemplates its policy path, it doesn't matter what the election calendar says. But the Fed chair also pushed back on calls for the Fed to do more on issues like climate change, a request that often comes from Democrats. "We also need to avoid mission creep," Mr. Powell said, citing climate change as something beyond the scope of the Fed. "Policies to address climate change are the business of elected officials and those agencies that they have charged with this responsibility," Powell added. The Fed, he said, has a narrow role that relates to our responsibilities as a bank supervisor, but is likely to come under pressure to expand that role, and we are not, nor do we seek to be, climate policymakers. While Mr. Powell was careful to avoid talking about immigration policy, he did note repeatedly that stronger than expected immigration has helped the economy to grow more strongly than economists thought it could, even as inflation has faded. The Congressional Budget Office this year increased its expectations for U.S. labor force growth and economic growth in the light of immigration trends. "When more people come into the country and labor force, there is more earning and spending in the economy, and output can expand without overheating the job market." Our economy has been short labor and probably still is, Mr. Powell said, but immigration explains what we've been asking ourselves, which is how can the economy have grown over 3% in a year where almost every outside economist was forecasting a recession? Next up from the New York Times, an article written by Kevin Roos titled, Did One Guy Just Stop a Huge Cyber Attack? The internet, as anyone who works deep in its trenches will tell you, is not a smooth, well-oiled machine. It's a messy patchwork that has been assembled over decades and is held together with the digital equivalent of scotch tape and bubblegum. Much of it relies on open-source software that is thanklessly maintained by a small army of volunteer programmers who fix the bugs, patch the holes, and ensure the whole rickety contraption, which is responsible for trillions of dollars in global GDP, keeps chugging along. Last week, one of those programmers may have saved the internet from huge trouble. His name is Andre Froome. He's a 38-year-old software engineer who lives in San Francisco and works at Microsoft. His job involves developing a piece of open-source database software known as PostgreSQL, whose details would probably bore you to tears if I could explain them correctly, which I can't. Recently, while doing some routine maintenance, Mr. Freund inadvertently found a backdoor hidden in a piece of software that is part of the Linux operating system. The backdoor was a possible prelude to a major cyber attack that experts say could have caused enormous damage if it had succeeded. Now, in a twist fit for Hollywood, tech leaders and cybersecurity researchers are hailing Mr. Freund as a hero. Satya Nadella, the chief executive of Microsoft, praised his curiosity and craftsmanship. An admirer called him the silverback gorilla of nerds. Engineers have been circulating an old famous among programmers web comic about how all modern digital infrastructure rests on a project maintained by some random guy in Nebraska. In their telling, Mr. Freund is the random guy from Nebraska. In an interview this week, Mr. Freund, who is actually a soft-spoken German-born coder who declined to have his photo taken for this story, said that becoming an internet folk hero has been disorienting. I find it very odd, he said. I'm a fairly private person who just sits in front of the computer and hacks on code. The saga began earlier this year when Mr. Freund was flying back from a visit to his parents in Germany. While reviewing a log of automated tests, he noticed a few error messages he did not recognize. He was jet-lagged, and the messages didn't seem urgent, so he filed them away in his memory. But a few weeks later, while running some more tests at home, he noticed that an application called SSH, which is used to log into computers remotely, was using more processing power than normal. He traced the issue to a set of data compression tools called XZutils, and wondered if it was related to the earlier errors he had seen. Don't worry if these names are Greek to you. All you really need to know is that these are all small pieces of the Linux operating system, which is probably the most important piece of open source software in the world. The vast majority of the world's servers, including those used by banks, hospitals, governments, and Fortune 500 companies, run on Linux, which makes its security a matter of global importance. Like other popular open source software, Linux gets updated all the time, and most bugs are the result of innocent mistakes. But when Mr. Freund looked closely at the source code for XZutils, he saw clues that it had been intentionally tampered with. In particular, he found that someone had planted malicious code in the latest versions of the XZutils software. The code, known as a backdoor, would allow its creator to hijack a user's SSH connection and secretly run their own code on that user's machine. In the cybersecurity world, a database engineer inadvertently finding a backdoor in a core Linux feature is little like a bakery worker who smells a freshly baked loaf of bread, senses something is off, and correctly deduces that someone has tampered with the entire global yeast supply. It's the kind of intuition that requires years of experience and obsessive attention to detail, plus a healthy dose of luck. At first, Mr. Freund doubted his own findings. Had he really discovered a backdoor in one of the world's most heavily scrutinized open source programs? It felt surreal, he said. There were moments where I was like, I must have just had a bad night of sleep and had some fever dreams. But his digging kept turning up new evidence, and last week, Mr. Freund sent his findings to a group of open source software developers. The news set the tech world on fire. Within hours, a fix was developed, and some researchers were crediting him with preventing a potentially historic cyber attack. This could have been the most widespread and effective backdoor ever planted in any software product, said Alex Stamos, chief trust officer at SentinelOne, a cybersecurity research firm. If it had gone undetected, Mr. Stamos said, the backdoor would have given its creators a master key to any of the hundreds of millions of computers around the world that run SSH. That key could have allowed them to steal private information, plant crippling malware, or cause major disruptions to infrastructure, all without being caught. Since his findings became public, Mr. Freund said he had been helping the teams who are trying to reverse engineer the attack and identify the culprit. But he's been too busy to rest on his laurels. The next version of PostgreSQL, the database software that he works on, is coming out later this year, and he's trying to get some last-minute changes in before the deadline. I don't really have time to go and have a celebratory drink, he said. Well, if he did, we should all buy him one. But you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'm Barry Slater. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day, and thank you for letting me give you the business.